Welcome to the second. Welcome to the second installment of Rabbis on the Run: A History of Persecution, Displacement, and Rebuilding. I want to thank again our very generous sponsors for the series, Len and Chani Grunstein, in memory of their fathers Morris Grunstein and Aaron Tambor, that our learning should be an aliyah for their neshamas. We thank you very much for your generous sponsorship. Okay. As a matter of housekeeping, there will not be a class next week because it is at the conclusion of Aseret B'Teves, and we had Rachmanus on our speakers and on our participants. But for tonight, we are speaking about the Shach and the Chmelnitsky massacres. However you pronounce that, you're welcome to do it on your own terms. I'll do my best as we go along. I had a really good time preparing this. I learned a lot, and as we'll see as the class develops, it gave me a tremendous sense of appreciation for the life and times that you and I live in. Obviously, we have in our day and age the Holocaust, which is a nearer installation, so to speak, of the Khmelnytsky massacres. But before the Holocaust, this was really the most tragic moment in for large parts of Jewish history. And we'll discuss a little bit as we go in exactly what made it so tragic. We'll learn a little bit about some of the firsthand accounts of what exactly took place, and why the Shach's name is attributed to the massacres. Who the Shach was, what time period did he live in, and exactly what his relationship is with the Khmelnytsky massacres. You'll see here that oftentimes these massacres are referred to Tach V'Tat. That's a lot easier for those of us who are not Russian to refer to it as. Now, why do we refer to it as Tach V'Tat? Because in the Hebrew language, the words Taf Chet and numerical value equals 408, and Tat is 409, Taf Tet. 408 and 409 equals the years 1648 and 1649. And so sometimes you'll hear the Gzeros Tach V'Tat. That's oftentimes how it is referred to. Again, that's just a relationship to the years of 1648, 1649, the years in which these massacres took place. You'll look here also and you'll notice a map. Now, even if you can't focus on the specific cities within the map, I want to focus on a few just to get our bearings geographically. Over here you have the Ukraine. For example, you have Kiev, you have the Dnieper River, which again I'm botching the name, but you'll forgive me. Okay? This is Ukraine. This is where the bulk of our story is going to begin. You'll also notice that here's Poland, cities that we're familiar with, like Warsaw and Krakow. And up here, you have Lithuania, where we have Vilna, Slutsk, Pinsk. Again, cities that we're familiar with, not because of Gzeros Tach V'Tat, but because, unfortunately, the modern-day incarnation of it, which is the Holocaust. What we're going to discuss tonight begins right around here and is going to spread all the way over here and all the way over there. So keep this in mind as we go through the events tonight, that we're starting here, but it's very much connected. Think about where the Polish and Ukrainian border, right? They're right next to each other, and Lithuania right here. It's all going to be intertwined. And everything that we're going to talk about while it starts here is really going to connect very much to a lot of the Jewish centers that we're talking about here, Warsaw and Krakow, Vilna, all of this. Is this have Lvov? This is Lvov right here, which we're going to talk about a little bit. Shklov we're going to talk a little bit about. So we're really going to stretch westward throughout the class. When we talk about the years leading up to Gzeros Tach V'Tat, the years leading up to 1648 and 1649. So there are a few things I want to mention that I think are critically important to understanding it. Number one is the messianic drive that existed at that period of time. Kabbalists believed that the year 1648 was going to be a significant time period in Jewish history, not because of the way that we're going to remember it tonight, but because, based on a Kabbalistic understanding of a pasuk in the Navi, that it was going to be the time when Mashiach was going to come. Of course, this is right around the time of Shabtai Tzvi. There were many messianic drives permeating the Jewish world. Now, that should come as no surprise to us. Anytime you see poverty, anytime you see pogroms, anytime you see the Jews are being abused, you'll notice that there are messianic tendencies that are going to rage throughout the Jewish world, and for good reason. And that is because people are looking for meaning. They're looking for context to suffering. can't be that God would cause us to suffer in a vacuum. And so it must be that there is some explanation to why it is that we are suffering. So number one is to understand the messianic portents of that period of time. The other thing that's very important to understand is that the time period leading up to 1648 were periods of relative peace, safety, and security for the Jewish people, and there was an abundance of Torah centers. Torah centers were flourishing. And so the contrast between the time period leading up to Gzeros Tachvatat, leading up to 1648, and what we'll see is going to happen afterwards, is significant. Many people, for this reason, consider this period of 1648, I'll really say till 1655, about a seven-year period, many people associate it with the onset of modern Judaism. That's when you kind of lead the Middle Ages, that's when you leave the time period of when the Shulchan Aruch is written, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go on, and we enter into the period of modern Judaism. Now, as we go on in the class, you'll understand more why people associate this time period with the movement of modern Judaism, why it really propels into motion the next, let's say, 300 years of Jewish history, basically until the Holocaust. And again, we'll study all of that as we go on. But it's important to recognize that in large part, this came out of nowhere. The Jewish people, again, were living in peace and prosperity. Jewish religious centers were thriving. And as oftentimes is the case, we are not the central focus of pogroms. We're not the central focus of why something starts. And yet, as it spreads, we get caught up on the onslaught. And that's exactly what's going to happen in this time period as well. State of the Jews. So we have over here that a little bit of a historical context for what exactly the Jews were doing during the lead up to Gzeros Tachvatat. The Jewish people were essentially tax collectors. They were tax collectors, and they were a state. They ran estates. Now, what I mean by that is as follows. Let me take you back to our original map here. You notice that Ukraine is over here and Poland is over here. What essentially happened was, and again, I'm obviously simplifying it for our context, but a lot of the castles and a lot of the estates that you will have come across in the Ukraine were not run by Ukrainian people. They were actually owned by Polish landlords. Now, if I live in Poland and I have an estate in the Ukraine, so I'm not going to be the one who's going to go and manage that estate, right? We have this in Florida as well. What do you do? What do you do? What do we Jewish people? We hire someone, right? So you hire someone to manage the estate for you. That's exactly what happened. Now, who were the Poles hiring to manage the estates? None other than the Jews. Now, because the Jews were managing the estates, how do you think the average Ukrainian felt about the Jewish people? They hated them. There was an enormous amount of animosity. And that is because the Jews were perceived as tyrants and oppressors. If my entire interaction with you was me collecting taxes and me collecting your debt, chances are you are not going to like me very much. And that's exactly what happens around this time period. And so I gave some examples on the slide over there of some of the taxes, taxes on birth, taxes on debt, taxes on the estate. And what happens is eventually when you can't pay your taxes, what do you go into? You go into debt. When you go into debt and you go into more debt and you go into more debt, we're going to see that next week's Parsha with Yosef. What essentially happens? The Polish landlords don't just own the estates, but who do they own? They own you. Well, if you're a Ukrainian, specifically if you're a Ukrainian peasant, are you going to be very happy about that? Not at all. And who are you going to take your wrath out on? Are you going to take a wrath out on a Polish landlord who lives hundreds and hundreds of miles to the west? Or are you going to take your wrath out on the Jew who's the face of that tyranny and the face of that oppression who lives down the block from you? And as we'll see, that is essentially what is going to happen as our narrative develops. There's another sidebar, which is not really a sidebar. It's actually a fundamental foundation of our understanding this entire time period. And that is, or starts, in the Great Schism of 1054. You and I, thank God, are Jewish. We're not Christians, so we're not as familiar with this. But we've studied world history enough to know that the Catholic Church in 1054 splits into two. there is, again, it comes in different forms, but essentially we'll call the Eastern Greek Orthodox Church, which is what the Ukrainians are going to subscribe to. And then there's the Roman Catholic Church, which the Polish landlords are going to subscribe to. Now, the differences between them, you can read on your own. All you have to know is that there is a fundamental difference between them. And this is not like, oh, you daven in the Shtibel Minyan and I daven in the 845 Minyan. And so we have different types of cholent at our Kiddush, right? In other words, the schism that existed between these two movements was very significant. And so a lot of the tension that is building up in the anticipation of 1648 is built on this. Not only was there an economic reason for the hatred between the Polish landlords and the average Ukrainian, specifically the peasants, and we'll talk about the Cossacks a little bit as we progress, but there was a significant religious hatred and religious animosity that existed between these two. And when we get to Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who's the face of this entire operation, so we'll notice, we'll see, that that was one of the driving wedges that he created to mobilize the Ukrainian peasants, to mobilize the Cossacks, to be able to attack their Polish landlords. Okay, why is this significant to us? Right, there are many massacres that have happened. There are many parts of Jewish history where they wanted to kill us and we're still around. Why is this so significant that when I emailed Rabbi Kasorl and I said, give me your top 12 rabbis on the run, he suggested the Shach and the Khmelnytsky massacres. I just gave you behind the bima how we choose these themes. Beginning of every year, I email Rabbi Kasorla. I say, this is what we want to talk about. This is the theme I thought of. Can you come up with 12 topics? He sends me about 20. I pick the 12 that I think are going to be the easiest for me and Rabbi Goldberg to find stuff on. He knows everything, so he doesn't need to prepare. But for us, we need to prepare something, okay? So the impact on Judaism. I want to give you a little bit of a context. Why this is so significant. Now, obviously, when we talk about numbers in the middle of the 17th century, numbers are not going to be exact. So this is the best guess. It's kind of taking the average, but a little bit on the lower side. But essentially, 10% of the Jewish population was wiped out. That number can go anywhere from 10% to 50%, depending on what scholarly work you're reading. That's a massive number of people. Entire communities were destroyed, and Jewish history was altered. Just to give you a little bit of a sense what that means, and I'll come to, I don't have the number here, but the number that we're going to take for tonight is around 200,000 Jews were murdered. Okay. Now again, that number could go up to 900,000. It could go down to 50,000. Again, I'm taking the one that I saw the most. Let's say 200,000 Jews. Just to put that in perspective a little bit for you. Because you might be sitting and saying, okay, 2,000 Jews, 200,000 Jews is tragic. The Holocaust, 6 million, that, right? Just put this into perspective. There was no form of mass murder back then. So when we talk about the murder and annihilation of 200,000 Jews in entire Jewish communities, how are they killed? Right? There's no gas chambers. How are they killed? Person by person. Right? So when you talk about the numbers of death that we're going to talk about, we are talking about a people that were bloodthirsty. We're talking about unbridled cruelty. We're talking about unspeakable atrocities, all done person to person. Now, when murder is done person to person, it's very different than dropping a cyanide pill into a gas chamber. I'm not minimizing that for a second, chas v'shalom, right? But there is a certain cruelty and brutality to what we're going to discuss tonight, okay? And that's what makes this, at least for bullet point number one, so significant. Obviously, as we discussed a little bit earlier, messianic movements are going to gain steam around this period of time. It's going to develop converts to these notions, because again, anytime you see Jewish suffering, there has to be a reason for it. Emerging from Gezeros Tach V'Tad is going to be Hasidism. Hasidism, according to many, is a direct result of Gezeros Tach V'Tad. Now, why is that? Again, I don't want to show all my cards, but essentially, when you have the destruction of massive Torah centers, and therefore the Jewish population is by and large less educated than it previously was, what you have to do is find a way to connect people to Judaism absent of major Torah centers. That, of course, creates the atmosphere and the environment for Hasidism to come along and say, you can be a water carrier, you can be a shoemaker, doesn't matter who you are, what you do, or how much Torah knowledge you have, because God can be found anywhere. You can be making shoes, and if you have the proper kavanas and connect yourself to the tzaddik, then you can be a righteous great Jew. Right? That created out of a vacuum, so to speak, of these mega Torah centers, where Jews were by and large less educated and less knowledgeable than they were prior to the destruction that we are going to talk about. It's going to have a massive impact on Jewish migration. And what I mean by that is as follows. Basically, from the 11th century all the way up until the 15th century, the Jews were moving eastward. So through Poland, through Lithuania, to the Ukraine. All of a sudden, after 1648, the Jews are so they're so bothered by what the Cossacks do and what the Ukrainians participate in. They are so nervous about this Cossack terror that it actually leads to a redistribution of world Jewry as it begins to migrate westward. And that's when you have Jews that are going to start living in places like France, places like Germany, places like Austria, right? So a lot of what we are going to see, let's say in the 19th century, even in the beginning of the 20th century, is all a byproduct of this Jewish migration westward, which is a shift in the trend from the eastward movement. So just think about some of the names that we're going to encounter as we progress in Jewish history. Names like Karl Marx, or names like Freud, or names like Albert Einstein. Just imagine for a moment if they had lived in the ghettos of the Ukraine or the Pale of the Settlement in Russia, right? As they migrate westward, and as you have Renaissance, thank you for the filling the word in that I was clearly looking for. As you have the Renaissance, right, that allows, again, it creates the environment for these Jews to be able to have the knowledge, the university life, all of that. That never would have happened had that westward migration not started. And lastly, is simply the impact on this astronomic number of deaths. Now, when we talk about deaths, it's not just the number of deaths, but you also have to understand the impact that it had on communities. And we're going to read a lot about this tonight. But take, let me give you a couple of examples, right? Ransoming. We'll see that the Cossacks, different than the peasants, Cossacks were very willing to take ransom. In fact, that may have been their kavana the entire time, right? You take a Jew, the Jewish community steps forward, ransoms a Jew. It's a very lucrative business back then. Well, that's a significant toll on the Jewish community. Let me give you another example. Widows, orphans, disabled. We're going to see tonight a number of testimonies given at Bate Dinim throughout the region, everywhere from Istanbul to Constantinople, right? And what's going to be one of the themes that we're going to talk about is how do you decide who is a widow and who's an aguna, right? If I testify that my husband was murdered in front of my eyes, is that testimony going to be accepted? So, for example, one of the people we're going to glance upon a little bit tonight, the Taz, who is a little bit older than the Shach, but very much plays in to that dynamic, and we'll talk about that at the end of this class. But the Taz has, in one of his comments on the Shulchan Aruch, the Taz writes, very almost autobiographically, that one can trust a wife to testify about the death of her husband if she says she saw it with her own eyes. Right? So these are some of the halachic body of literature that emerges from this time. So it wasn't just, 200,000 people were murdered, a terrible tragedy, but it was a significant impact on the Jewish community. Conversion, we're going to talk a little bit about the conversion as well tonight. That was definitely one of the goals of the Cossacks as well. Death or conversion, again, a narrative that unfortunately is not new to us as the Jews, and again, is also plays out in Jewish history. So the point of this slide is to sensitize you to the fact that this has a significant, enormous impact on basically the next 300 years of the Jewish history. And basically from now until the Holocaust, it shifts dramatically everything we've spoken about, whether it's the centers of learning, whether it's the migration. We'll talk about a little bit at the end where the center of Jewish life moves from Poland essentially to Lithuania, where it stays up until the Holocaust. So understanding the Holocaust really begins with understanding the migration that we're going to talk about a little bit tonight. Okay, the background to the Khmelnytsky massacres. 1637, there was a large uprising of local peasants and Cossacks in the Ukraine. Over the next 3 years, an estimated 2,000 Jews are going to be murdered. You have here that in 1940, the Poles reasserted their dominance. There was a truce that was cut with the Ukrainian Cossacks. The leaders were caught, executed, and everyone was calm. And everyone was peaceful, all the way up until 1648. 1648, you have, that comes on the scene, a man by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Again, whether that's a K-H, a C-H, how you pronounce it, I'll leave that for the Russians in our crowd. What do we know about Khmelnytsky? We know that he was the son of a wealthy landowner, that he participated in a Ukrainian war where he was held captive for 2 years. We also know that he was a firm defender of the Roman, a strong follower of Russian Greek Orthodoxy against Roman Catholicism. Again, that comes back to that previous slide, that there was a definite religious component to this. And we also know that he was in a fight with a man by the name of Daniel Shaplinsky. Okay? Daniel Shaplinsky and he were fighting over, what do men usually fight over? Women. Over a woman by the name of Elena. In addition to that, this individual, Shaplinsky, so he was the assistant governor, and when Khmelnytsky appealed to Poland for assistance, they received no assistance whatsoever, and the two of them got in a dispute over land, they got a dispute over women. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because it essentially pitted Khmelnytsky at odds with the Polish landowners. All of this takes us up to this slide. In Ukraine nowadays, this is a statue of Khmelnytsky that sits in Ukraine to this very day. He is considered a national hero. Now, why is he considered a national hero? Because, according to them, he defended the oppressed masses. He was a hero of the downtrodden. And he was a benefactor of the exploited peasants. So if you were a peasant back then, and you were burdened with debt from your Polish landlord, and all of a sudden Khmelnytsky comes and defends you and protects you and gives you that courage and that sense of invincibility, so largely he is considered a hero. Obviously, we do not. When we talk about Khmelnytsky, we refer to him as Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, because no different than Hitler, he was mad for lust of blood, right? I mean, he really led to the murder and annihilation of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews. April 1648, he begins his two quick victories against the Polish landlords, and he is able to capture a number of Polish castles. Now, what happens when you have a general that has two very quick victories in succession? All of a sudden, it fuels his reputation. Don't forget, there was no Twitter back then. There was no Facebook. There was no CNN or Fox News or Wall Street Journal. So when you heard about this massive, strong, courageous general who was victorious against the big, bad Polish landlords and capturing estates, all of a sudden, what do? All of a sudden, you want to be on his team. So essentially, very little changed in the dynamic between the Polish landlords and the Ukrainian peasantry, with one exception. And that is that they now had a hero on which to hang their hats. These quick victories gave Khmelnytsky that sense of confidence, it gave him that sense of victory, and it gave him that sense of invincibility. Despite a truce with the Poles, right after a number of those short victories, as we say, the genie was let out of the bottle. Now, what I mean by that the genie is let out of the bottle? When you give hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Ukrainian peasants and Cossacks weapons, and you give them that lust for blood, that they've tasted what it means to kill someone and feel the power that comes along with it, and then you tell them to stop, how many of them stop? None. And essentially, that's what leads them to take out their frustration on none other than the Jews. This did not start off as a battle between the Jews and the Ukrainians, as a battle between Khmelnytsky and the Jews. this started off as Ukrainian peasantry versus the Polish landlords. It was about oppression. It was about debt. It was about rights, right? And all of a sudden, the Jews get caught in the middle. Now, why are the Jews get caught in the middle? For exactly the reasons we articulated at the beginning. The peasantry resented the Jewish population. They were the landlords. They were the tyrants. They were the oppressors. And all of a sudden, you have these men who have a thirst for blood, who have weaponry, who've tasted the power that comes along with capturing other people, and the genie is out of the bottle. And so what essentially you have is thousands and thousands of peasants who are now walking around armed. They have no discipline whatsoever. They have tasted blood, and they have turned themselves into a mob of raging killers. And that is where we essentially come to the Jewish community, because the Jews get caught up in the middle of it. The Jews, we're going to read in a moment testimonials of the Jews running for their lives. And we'll see, when we talk about running for their lives, right? There was a dirt road that connected villages. So when an entire city has to evacuate at the drop of a hat, what you end up with is overcrowded highways. You end up with people who think that they could take all of their gold and silver and china and all that fancy stuff, and they essentially have to dump it on the side of the road. You have families that are separated one from another, because if my child is going too slow, or if my wife can't keep up, and there's a massive horde of people, chances are you and I are going to get separated, and that's the end of it. We're going to lose contact altogether. And so, you have Jewish communities that try ransoming other Jews. I have here Cossacks versus the peasants. We'll see that in a little bit. Whereas the Cossacks were very open to Jews being ransomed, the peasants, let's just say, were not. They were much more interested in flat-out murder. You have a number of Gedolei Yisrael. These are just to name a few. We're going to talk about Rabbi Chiel Michal of Nemirov in a little bit. He's a name that's going to come up a lot tonight. And here I gave 300,000, okay? But in basically a five-year period, essentially 300,000 Jews are murdered. That is a lot of people to kill when you're essentially going door to door. When you don't have the mechanisms of mass murder, that is obviously a very, very significant number. I have here, I don't expect any of you to read it, because I can't read it. I notice it's very blurry here. Every one of these is a town that was directly impacted, if not annihilated, by the Khmelnytsky massacres in that five-year period of 1648 to 1653. Now, even if you cannot read any of these, right, I hope you can see that there are a lot of towns represented here. A lot of towns that if I read them to you, which apparently I'm getting older because I can't, but a lot of towns that you would recognize the name of. So we have Shklov over here. We have Lvov down here. We have, Kiev. You have some pretty prominent cities that you and I, Mezrich is going to be down here, right? These are names of cities, names of towns that you and I are very familiar. Did I even print it off here? No, I didn't print it off. See, I was trying to save paper, and so I didn't print off the page that has all of those cities. Okay, but it's a lot of cities. I hope you get a sense. The fact that I had to make that print so small gives you a little bit of an insight into just how many cities we're talking about that were impacted. When I say impacted, it's not a good thing to be impacted. Okay, what do we know about this time period? How do we know about this time period? Well, there are two primary texts, certainly in rabbinic literature, that we're going to rely upon when we talk about this time period. Number one is called Yevon Metzula. Yevon Metzula was written by Rav Natan of Hanover, who is a student of the Maharsha. Yevon, we know from Yavan, means Greek, and that is because the Ukrainians belong to the Greek Orthodox Church. And he essentially writes a book describing community by community of what happened during this five-year period. Let me give you a couple of examples. These are English translations. If you would like, and I really just did this to impress you for no other reason, but if you go to pages, you don't have to, but pages 5, just in case you want to read it on your own later, but pages 5 through 8 has essentially what I'm about to read for you in English, in Hebrew. I'm sorry, what I'm about to read for you in English, it has for you in Hebrew. So if you don't trust my English translation. You can read it in the Hebrew, and you could all be impressed by my ability to use Otzra Chachma. Okay? But let's just read. I want to show you two towns. One is Nemirov, which, again, we remember we discussed just a second ago, of Yechiel Michal of Nemirov. So here we go. The people of the city were fully aware of this trickery. What trickery was he talking about? That as the Cossacks were descending on the city of Nemirov, the Jews ran away. Where do you hide? In the fortress. Town had a fortress. Right? They made Israel the bomb shelter. So they go to the fortress, and this group of Cossacks come. Now, they weren't wearing a sign that says, I am a Cossack. So what did they try to do? They tried to trick the Jewish population. And therefore, they appeared with Polish flags. Polish flags, Polish landlords, that's my friend, that's my boss, that's the guy who pays my bills. So he writes here that the people of the city were fully aware of this trickery and nevertheless called to the Jews in the fortress, open the gate. This is a Polish army which has come to save you from the hands of your enemies. So they try to trick the Jewish people, right? Open the door, I'm your friend, I'm nice, right? We're buddies. Okay. No sooner had the gates been opened than the Cossacks entered with drawn swords, and the town people too, armed with spears and scythes, and some only with clubs, and they killed the Jews in large numbers. Again, you don't need a vivid imagination to understand how brutal, cruel this entire experience was. Women and young children were ravished, that is a generous term, but some of the women and maidens jumped into the moat surrounding the fortress in order that the uncircumcised should not defile them. But the Ukrainians swam after them with their swords and their scythes and killed them in the water. Some of the enemy shot with their guns into the water and killed them till the water became blood red with the blood of the slain. The number of slain and drowned in the holy community of Nemirov was about 6,000. They perished by all sorts of terrible deaths. May God avenge their blood. 6,000 people by clubs, by spears, by swords, right? You can just imagine how traumatic that must have been. Then we come to the city of Polonia. Here again, among them was a wise and understanding divinely inspired Kabbalist whose name was our teacher and our master, Rav Samson of the holy community of Astropoli. Okay, now I gave you this example because I want to show you that the dramatic effect on learning, right? When you kill the teachers, you kill the Torah centers as well. He preached frequently in the synagogue and exhorted the people to repent so that the evil would not come to pass. Accordingly, all the communities repented sincerely, but it did not avail, for the evil decree had already been sealed. When the enemies and the oppressors invaded the city, the above-mentioned mystic and 300 of the most prominent citizens, all dressed in shrouds, with prayer shawls over their heads, entered the synagogue and engaged in fervent prayer. When the enemies arrived, they killed all of them upon the sacred grounds of the synagogue. May God avenge their blood. Many thousands, hundreds, who managed to survive were forced to change their faith, and many hundreds were taken captive by the Tartars, again, who, without getting into too much detail, were in alliance with the Cossacks. So that is an example. When we talk about the Yevon Metsula, which is not a particularly lengthy work, again, you can get it on Otzar HaChachma, probably about 60 pages, but it goes city by city, town by town, with accounts like this. It's actually not particularly difficult Hebrew. I was surprised by that, which is why I gave you an excerpt there. And if you're able to make your way through the Hebrew, it's a really powerful read on Tisha B'Av, 3 weeks, that time period, because it'll really give you an understanding of just how traumatic this time period was. If you open up the source sheets that I have in front of you, I just want to read for you a couple of other excerpts before we move on to our next slide, which is the Shach. You're probably wondering, we are 33 minutes into the Shiur, and all I've talked about is the Bchelminski massacres haven't touched the Shach at all. We'll get to it in a second. Open up to page number 1. And again, these are all English. We can all read them on our own. I just think they're so powerful. This is the Tolchin Massacre. This is a testimony to the Beis Din in Lvov, August 6, 1648. And he writes the following. This is the preceding this testimony. It's by an individual, we know his first name to be Hanan, and he is writing about the murder of one of his friends whose name is Leib. Okay, so that's the backdrop that we know about this. About 8 days before the massacre of Tolchin, there was fighting in the region, but no one wanted to let the local population get away. The noble lord forced them all to flee in great distress from Komarid to Tolchin. So Laban, his brother Melech, came here too. I was with them in the fortress. Then the noble lord Shmetvitsky did a deal with the Cossacks to hand the Jews over to them. What do you see immediately? What do you see immediately? What are the Cossacks interested in? Ransom, right? You see that the locals are ransoming the Jews. This was, as I said, a lucrative business. On Thursday, these captives were taken away to Uman. So why are they taken to Uman? Because Uman is where the Cossack headquarter is. So there's a deal that's cut between the local town people and the Cossacks. Money is changing hands. And the Jews are being shipped to the Cossack headquarters in Uman. On the Saturday, the peasants arrived running into the courtyard outside the fortress. You'll notice there is now a new entity in this calculation. You had the Cossacks, you had the local townspeople, and now who do you have? Peasants. Now you know, because I already sensitized this to you, the Cossacks and the peasants want two different things. Peasants are okay with ransom. The Cossacks are okay with the ransom. What do the peasants want?
Blood.
So all of a sudden the peasants arrive. Laban and his brother Melech were standing in the corner at the end of the courtyard. I was between them. And then I ran away with some other people and saw that the peasants immediately began to kill the people in the corner. I saw my grandmother and my stepmother killed with others. Escape was next to impossible. Next, thousands of peasants broke into the fortress. So those who had fled there were killed in that place. So they came here to seek refuge. Thousands of peasants. Again, you can just picture the scene of thousands of bloodthirsty, vile people running into this fortress and with essentially their hands, clubs, spears, murdering person after person after person. If you look in the next source, this is a testimony in the Beis Din of Ostrog in 1649. This gives a little bit of an insight into what I'm going to call the chaos of the war and who to trust. We, that is my husband, Avram Ben Yisrael, and I, fled from the mob going from village to village until we came to one called Zviriz. Now, what's interesting about this is one of the things you'll notice in this writing is that when you came to a new city, who can you trust? Who do you stay by? How do you know where to go? Right? So you see that in this excerpt. There we came across a good peasant who put us up for about 3 weeks. Then my husband said, "Why are we sitting here? Let's go on. Maybe we will come to a Jew." So we came to a village called Preslovich, where I became sick. My husband sat beside me in the non-Jew's house, but then the hooligans came, and a villager handed my husband over to them. They tied him hand and foot and kept him overnight. Early in the morning they came to him and said, "What shall we do with you, shoot you or behead you?" He asked to be shot. Then I came and asked them to shoot me too. One hooligan said to the other, "Cut her head off." The other said, "Ah, she's sick, she'll die anyways." Another hooligan shot him through the heart from behind and he fell. The hooligans left and I sat beside my husband. He remained alive for half an hour, not saying anything, just sleeping. Then his soul left him. I buried him with the help of the non-Jew with whom I was staying. Still sick, I remained with the non-Jew for 3 weeks after my husband's death. So you get like a sense. The non-Jew helps her, but another non-Jew had turned her husband over. Just you see the cruelty that takes place during that time period. This source, again, I'll leave it with you. You can read it on its own. This describes the escape. Right, we talk about the refugee crisis. This was a refugee crisis. Jews who were escaping, Jews who left with everything and then had to abandon stuff along the way. This is on page number 2 of the sheets that I gave you. Right, so again, you can read that on your own. What's interesting is the common denominator. Right, when Jews are running away, it didn't matter if you were rich or you were poor. At the end of the day, you were throwing stuff off the side. When you read this source, I want you to get a sense of fear. I want you to get a sense of uncertainty. I want you to get a sense of the chaos that was ensuing at that time period. As they're running, right? So not only are their possessions bogging them down, but also it's making them a target, right? When you're slow and you're carrying an enormous amount of stuff with you, so you now become a target for those who are pursuing you. Turn to page number 3 for a second. This again is a quote from Yevhen Metsula, which again we discussed a little bit earlier. Some Jews were skinned alive and their flesh thrown to the dogs. Some had their hands and legs cut off, with their bodies thrown on the highway to be run over by wagons and trampled by horses. Others were seriously but not mortally wounded and thrown aside to die slowly, writhing in their own blood until their souls left them. Many were buried alive. The enemy slaughtered infants in their mother's lap. Many children were torn into pieces like fish. This next part is right out of the Holocaust. It's right out of Kinos. It's right out of really the Tochacha. They slashed the bellies of pregnant women, removed their fetuses, punched them in the face. They tore open the bellies of some of the women and put live cats in. They then sewed up their bellies and cut off their hands. They were unable to take the live cats out of their bellies. They hung the infants on their, right? You just get a sense of, again, I'm not showing this to you to gross you out. I'm not showing this to you to depress you. But I think it's important for us to realize that when we talk about the massacres of Tach V'Tat, I believe firmly in unsanitizing these experiences. We should know exactly what it is that were done to our people. Go to the next source. This was a testimony in a Beis Din in Istanbul in the 1660s. He writes, about 20 years ago, the Cossacks came to Nemirov and took about 150 Jewish householders from the town to a courtyard where they locked them in. Then they then dug a very big, deep pit in the courtyard and killed Jews as they were standing on its edge. As he was killed, each one fell into that deep pit. The first to be killed was her husband, who fell straight in. Afterwards, they killed all the others who fell in the pit on top of him. They covered them with soil, put in, right, again, she testified she was the only survivor because a monk begged them not to kill her. He wanted to convert her and raise her as his daughter. The last one I'll share with you, just turn to page 4. I think this is a very important testimony as well. This is in the introduction to a Sefer Tiferes Yisrael. He was the rabbi of Shklov in Belarus, and he writes the following. Now, the reason why I think this is so powerful is, first of all, it's rare in its autobiographical candor, and number two is it shows you just how traumatic this was. Remember I had a slide earlier where I said it wasn't just those who died, but it was the impact on the community as a whole. This is a good example of this. He writes, when I was 8 or 9, I studied with a private teacher in Chlosk. It was the beginning of 1648 massacres, and we had been driven out of our land. My father and teacher, the pious Rav Aaron Yaffe, had been the rabbi of Uman community in the Ukraine, and we had been driven out of there. Every day after Marv, I used to go on the roof with a volume of the Talmud I had for my studies to practice reading. While I was up there, I burst into floods of tears, prayed to the Holy One, blessed be He, and banged my head on the roof, all in prayer to the God of Israel, that He should reveal to me the light of His Holy Torah. Right? So, those who even survived, and those who lived, the trauma is palpable, the trauma is real. Every night, going up to a rooftop, tears pouring down from his face as he beseeched God to create some level of salvation for him and for his people, to shine God's countenance on them in a positive fashion. Now, we are now 43 minutes in, and you're all wondering, what about the Shach? Right? Moskowitz, it's the Shach in the Khmelnytsky massacres. So what does the Shach have to do with all this? Who is the Shach? So the Shach is a very important figure in Jewish history. Rav Shabtai Kohn, otherwise known as the Shach, this is not so clear. He's born in 1621 in Lithuania, in a small town in all likelihood near Vilna, dies in 1662. That's a very short period of time, and yet he accomplishes a tremendous amount. Child prodigy, learned under of Yeshua Heschel in Krakow, and then Rav Nata Shapiro, who is the Megala Amukos. Again, these are famous Rabbanim at the time. At the age of 17, he writes a kuntras called Tukva Kohen, marries a very prominent individual, the daughter of Rav Shimon Wolf, who's a great-granddaughter of the Rama. More notably, he was a very prominent and very wealthy individual. He becomes a dayan in Vilna. Now, you'll say to me, Vilna? Vilna's far away from the Ukraine, right? As 1648 progresses into 1649, 50, 51, 52, 53, it impacts other Jewish communities as well. And so, eventually, the Shach has to run away. As the Cossacks reach Lublin, massacre 10,000 Jews, the Shach escapes to Prague, and then to Moravia, where he dies in 1662. Why are we talking about the Shach? Well, before I get to the Shach's connection with all of this, I want to give you a 5-minute understanding of why the Shach is so critical in the totality of, or the evolution of Halacha. Okay? Just, you can't leave here without knowing who the Shach was. So the Shach was significant for us in that he writes a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. which is called the Sifsei Kohen, which Shin Chaf, that's how you get the Shach, right? His mother didn't call him Shach. Okay, the Shach is after the work that he writes. Now, you'll notice on the other side of the Shulchan Aruch is called the Turei Zahav. Okay, that's written by someone named the Taz. Now, again, his mother didn't call him the Taz either. His name was Rav David Halevi. Now, you'll notice just age-wise, Rav David Halevi is born in 1586 and dies in 1667, which means he's about 40 years senior to the Shach. Okay, that's important to understand. Okay? The Shach decides at a very young age, in 1646, which means he's how old? He was born in 1621. 25. Right? Very young age. He writes a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Now, what makes that so audacious is you have to understand, when was the Shulchan Aruch written? Middle of what century? 16th century. So the 1500s. Okay? We assume that the Shulchan Aruch is the Shulchan Aruch, that it's the be-all and end-all of halachic psak and of halachic works. Right? We skip over 500 years of Jewish history. When the Shulchan Aruch is first written, not everyone loves the Shulchan Aruch. It's important to understand that. Because not everyone loves one unified body of halachic work. Right? Imagine if I came along and said, every Jew is going to paskin like me halachically. I'm guessing there would be a number of rabbis in America who would have a problem with that and say, who died and made Moskowitz the be-all and end-all? So not everyone loved the fact that Rav Yosef Karo came along and said that this is my consolidated book of halachic writing where I'm taking 1,500 years of Jewish scholarship and creating one unified, concise body of halachic law. And so it was not so clear-cut that the Shulchan Aruch was going to be what the Shulchan Aruch eventually became. What essentially crystallizes the Shulchan Aruch as a major body of halachic work is when the Shach writes a commentary on it. Okay? If you write a commentary on someone else's work, what have you now given to that other person's work? You've given it validity. You've propped it up. You've made it more chashuv in the eyes of the entire world. So the moment the Shach comes out with his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, everyone essentially says, who? If there's a work that now has a commentary on it, this work must be significant in and of itself. Not everyone loves the Shach for doing that, though. Because at the age of 25 years old, when the Taz is 40 years his senior, and in the exact same year comes out with his writing on the Shulchan Aruch, who do you think resents the Shach more than anyone else? The Taz. Taz is less than happy. And so there is a back and forth, to put it gently, between the two of them. So for example, the Shach comes out with his work, the Taz comes out with his work essentially the same year, and you have them writing back and forth to them. So for example, in Nekudas HaKesef, they go back and forth in rabbinic literature. You see this also between the Ramban and the Balaam. Or for example, oftentimes when I'll write a work and you'll respond to my work, I'll then respond to it in a different work, and you'll respond to it in a different work. And now all of a sudden we have four essential books, each in response to the other one. That's what happens with the Shach and the Taz. The Shach is essentially an encyclopedia of Jewish sources. He also writes the Nekudas HaKesef, which is an attack back on the Taz. And many people were not enthralled by what the Shach did because, again, they felt that he jumped over people who were more senior to him. Nonetheless, we generally, in a halachic dispute between the Shach and the Taz, we will generally, by and large, paskin like the Shach. And the reason why we do that is because many people felt that his work, because it was encyclopedic, and because he came with 15 approbations at the beginning of his work, that emerged as, I guess, the somewhat preeminent work on the subject. And again, if we were giving a class about the Shach and the Taz, I would go into that a little bit more in depth. Why are we talking about the Shach, though? Because the Shach writes a critically important work. We talked about the Yevan Metsula, where he went village by village describing the catastrophe and describing the murder. The Shach also writes what essentially is a lamentation. He writes a kina about Gzeros Tachvatat. It's called Megillas Eifa, and you have it here on page number 9 in your work. Also not a very lengthy work, about 25 pages, which again you can access on Otzer HaChachma. I have here for you on page number 9 the cover page for it. Megillas Eifa, Lemazkeres Avon, Shechibur HaChacham HaShalem Shabtai Kohen. Right, that's the Shach. Again, as it talks about Bishnas Chamesh Salafim Tach V'tat, this is the exact time period that we are talking about. Let me read for you one excerpt in English, and the rest I'm going to read for you in Hebrew that you have here in your source. First, the English. He writes here, on the same day, 1,500 people were killed in the city of Human in Russia on Shabbos. The noble Cossacks with whom the wicked mom had again made an alliance chased all the Jews from the city into the fields and vineyards where the villains surrounded them in a circle, stripped them down to their skin, and ordered them to lie on the ground. The villains spoke to the Jews with friendly, consoling words. Why do you want to be killed, strangled, slaughtered like an offering to your God who poured out his anger upon you? In other words, we have an easy solution. Would it not be safer for you to worship our gods, our images and crosses? And we would form one people from which we'd unite together. Sounds a lot like what story in the Torah? Shechem. Right, when Shechem they want, they say, we'll all be together. But the holy and faithful people who so often allowed themselves to be murdered for the sake of Hashem raised their voices together. They cried out, Shema Yisrael, we have been murdered for the sake so often already. Right, let us remain faithful to you. Afterward, they recited Vidui and said, we are guilty, Chatanu Avinu. Now the villains turned upon them, and there was not one of them who did not fall victim. So again, you see this notion of dying al Kiddush Hashem. I have for you here on pages 10, 11, 12, 13, basically until the end of your packet, some Hebrew excerpts that I was unable to translate, but I want to give you just a little bit of a sense of the Hebrew. Now, the reason why I want to give you a little bit of sense of Hebrew, recognizing that many of us are going to not be able to follow the Hebrew, is I want to give you a sense of the vocabulary that's used. This is poetic in nature. It's the same way you'll read Akina on Tisha B'Av. It's not written in prose. It's almost written more like poetry. So too, here you have as well, I want to give you a sense of the poetic nature of what he is writing. He says, and that's a translation of this. Okay, perfect. So let's go to the next page. I don't need to read that for you again. But go to page number 12, okay, where I have that little bad star up top. Umisham yipardu ha-goyim ha-reikim. Ha-goyim ha-reikim, the empty are the Cossacks we're talking about. Vahayu lahar be-roshim. V'yifshetu al-artenu. They spread out on our land. Vayacharivu kol mekomosenu. They destroyed all of our places. V'yarsu kol batei knesiyosenu, and they massacred, they annihilated all of our shuls. Uvekilos kedosho chernivav hargu kmo shnei alafim nefashos b'nei briseinu. They killed 2,000 people. Uvekilos kedosha stradav hargu kmo yudbeis meos 1,200. Umavada shir hargu b'mesilos udrachim. Aside from that, on the way, in other words, on the roads, they killed meos va'alafim nashamu misilosenu ve'iva nisilosenu. There was just mass murder all around the world. Umavana sher mesu barav v'etzama v'yamim unechalim ad kinev chula dami arenu. People died of plague. They died of starvation. They died of dehydration until our rivers were filled with blood. B'cherev uvedever uverav shtafanu serenu. With sword and with plague and with hunger, we were oppressed. Umavada sher inu vizinu vitimu besulos v'nashim kam v'yos leinenu. And aside from the death, how many women were pillaged and raped? V'olichu shvi lameos v'alafim besulos v'nashim l'arzenu. And people were taken captive. Al elu chashku enenu. And these are eyes. Almost we can't believe it. Gam karu v'sarfu be'ish kol svarenu akdoshim, and they destroyed our Sifrei Torah. Al zed avali benu v'lo nishar ruach b'kabenu. We can't even speak about it. Ha'al eile tis abek v'techeseh Hashem Elokeinu. Right? What does this sound very familiar to? Kinos and Tisha B'Av. I mean, Kinos and the Holocaust. Right? That's why I read it for you, because I want you to understand that this was a Kina. This, by the way, factors into the discussion of which day to make the commemoration of the Holocaust. Do you make a new day, or do you lump it into other days? It's going to play into this conversation as well. But it sounds very much like Kinos, and the stories of what the Cossacks do to us sounds very much like stories of what the Ukrainians, Poles, right, what they did to us in the time of the Holocaust as well. If you go to page 13, again, we're not going to read it, but you can read on your own. But you see there, it's a listing of great rabbis that were murdered as well. And again, I just give that to you so you understand exactly what it is that's in his work. So that's the Megillas Eifa. And that's when I assume Rabbi Ksorla gave me this topic of the Shach and the Chmelnytsky massacres. It's because he had written one of the primary sources that we have detailing the trauma and the catastrophe that befell the Jewish people. One other note that I just want to share with you, and that is the fast of the 20th day of Sivan. Here you have a kina that was composed for the 20th day of Sivan. The reason why it was chosen the 20th day of Sivan, it was the first attack of Nemirov. It was also the first blood libel in 1171. Nevad Arba Ratzos banned certain types of entertainment. That fast of the 20th of Sivan is the precedent for saying, why should we create a new day for Holocaust commemoration? We already have pre-existing days where we already are mourning, and therefore perhaps we should clump them together. That factors in to that conversation as well. So, to summarize, when we talk about the Shach and the Chmelnytsky massacres, this is a period of Jewish history which is changes the flow from essentially the 11th to the middle of the 17th century, where the Jews are migrating eastward, where at least for the period leading up to that, they're living in peace, in prosperity, and there are Jewish centers of Torah learning throughout Poland. Again, a lot of those communities that I mentioned are familiar to us. This is a dramatic shift in it. Now you understand a little bit about why people consider it to be the onset of modern Jewish history. Because as they migrate from the Ukraine and come up to Lithuania and establish some of those Torah centers in Lithuania, as the Hasidic movement gains steam, all of this is going to shape the conversations of the 18th century, the 19th century, and the beginning of the 20th century, of course, until the Holocaust, when all of Eastern Europe is essentially wiped out from a Jewish perspective. The Chmelnytsky massacres is, when we talk about traumatic events in Jewish history, the Chmelnytsky massacres is arguably one of the most traumatic. It's the Holocaust, it's the Chmelnytsky massacres, it's the blood libels and the Crusades in the 12th century. Those three periods essentially are significant. And hopefully we understand a little bit of the trauma, a little bit of the chaos, a little bit of the impact on the Jewish people, and hopefully also a greater appreciation. As I was preparing this class, I couldn't but help but be appreciative for the day and age that we live in. And while there are challenges and difficulties both here in America with anti-Semitism, in Israel with our neighbors, some of whom are more friendly than others, as I was preparing and as I was reading a lot of the testimonials, you couldn't but help but be overwhelmed with appreciation for the security and the safety in the day and age in which we live in. And I kept on coming back. I was preparing over Hanukkah, and I kept on coming back to that notion of the miraculous survival of the Jewish people. It is nothing short of miraculous that the Jewish people in the aftermath of Gzeros Tach V'Tad, in the aftermath of 1648 to 1653, were able to rebuild centers of Torah learning in Lithuania, were able to migrate and recreate themselves in the Germany, France, Vienna, those types of areas. That is nothing short of miraculous. We are living that in our day and age as well, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the annihilation of 6 million Jews, where once again, we showed that grit, we showed that ability to bounce back as a people, to regenerate and recreate and commit ourselves to more Torah learning, to greater flourishing of Jewish life and Jewish culture. And all I kept on saying to myself as I was reading and learning and preparing over the holiday of Hanukkah is, really, we are the miracle, as Shweki said. But it really is true. When you read about these time periods, it is a miracle that the Jewish people survived. It is a miracle not only that we survived, but that we recreated ourselves and thrived, and we have done so through consistently throughout Jewish history. I benefited enormously by preparing about this, both from a Jewish history perspective, an understanding of why this was such a seminal moment in that pivot from, let's say, 11th to 15th into modern Jewish history, how it started to shape so much of what we know about what's going to happen with Zionism, about what's going to happen with Hasidism, or what's going to happen with Lithuanian Jewry in the lead up to the Holocaust. And ultimately, for me, it was an enormous appreciation for the survival of the Jewish people. And with that, I wish everyone a wonderful